Okay, we will start this committee. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee meeting of Monday, March 9th, 2015. We don't quite yet have a quorum, but we will get going. And once we have a quorum, then we can take action on the bills. Members, we have five bills before us, and we will start with Senate File 1376, Senator Peterson. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, I want to thank you for accommodating our schedule. We had some testifiers that are from greater Minnesota and have quite a distance to travel, so I appreciate you moving us up on the agenda. I also want to thank a number of the other authors that have worked on this particular bill, Senator Senjum, Chair Dibble, and Senator Rood, as well as Senator Rosen and myself are all authors on this particular bill. Today you have before you Senate File number 1376, which is an effort and really a bill that would add an additional active transportation program that would benefit both greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities metropolitan area, relating specifically to bicycle and pedestrian walkways. This bill has the support of many organizations that you've heard of in the past, the Healthy Kids Coalition, a blend at CenterCare up in St. Cloud, CenterCare Health, American Heart Association, as well as the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, and many others. I hope that I have not left any out. This bill is an effort to model what was is done with another very successful program. You're all aware of a bill and a program called Safe Routes to Schools. This bill accomplishes the same thing for pedestrian and bike paths in an effort to provide funding for construction of those particular paths. Many of you know the momentum is growing for these types of pedestrian and bicycle paths in our community, and my hope is that you can support those as we move forward this afternoon with this bill. Mr. Chair, we have a couple testifiers that have come in to help present this and show us why we ought to be supporting this effort.
Great. Thank you, Senator Peterson. I have Jody Gertkin, blend coordinator, Centra Healthcare Center. Are you going to go first? Great.
Sure.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and then proceed.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Peterson has mentioned, my name is Jody Gertkin, and I am the coordinator for BLEND, which stands for Better Living, Exercise, and Nutrition Daily. It's an initiative of CenterCare Health in St. Cloud, whose mission is to reduce childhood obesity in the greater St. Cloud area by 10% by 2016. At CenterCare, health is at our core because it's our mission to improve the health of every patient every day. And we are striving to do so by making healthy choices the easiest choices for our patients and within our communities. I'd like to thank Senator Peterson for introducing this legislation to establish the first ever active transportation program in Minnesota. Your leadership throughout the St. Cloud area on programs like Safe Routes to School speaks volumes for your understanding and the importance of safe pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure, not just for your constituents, but for Minnesotans as a whole. I'm here to support Senate File 1376. This legislation would help my organization's goal of promoting healthy behaviors and prevent many chronic diseases which result from physical inactivity. Sadly, more than 60% of Minnesotans, adults, are overweight or obese. This means roughly 2.2 million Minnesotans are at risk for high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, heart disease, and certain forms of cancer. Just 54% of Minnesotans meet the required minimum weekly level of physical activity of 150 minutes. Overweight and obesity and chronic related diseases are on the rise, and as a healthcare organization, we have decided to make a concerted effort to prevent chronic disease and help keep our people healthy. Our communities have a lot to do with our health. In St. Cloud and many surrounding communities, we are working to make physical activity a regular part of everyday life by supporting sidewalks and bicycle infrastructure that supports safe walking and biking, especially for our youth and our senior citizens. Recently, you may have heard the City of St. Cloud approved spending $6.2 million for an extension of the Beaver Island Trail through downtown St. Cloud along the Mississippi River. City leaders recognize that this expensive investment to connect the metro area city's regional trails will provide great long-term payback, including increased opportunity for recreation, community boosting and tourism, and some economic benefit. Unfortunately, this is not the status quo, and most communities in greater Minnesota do not have the resources to devote to similar projects. St. Cloud's investment demonstrates, however, the statewide momentum for including safe walking and biking opportunities in our communities, both large and small. We have some great success stories to share, but also some gaps in what we've been able to achieve. Fortunately, through a collaborative effort with the City of Sartell and the Sartell St. Stephen School District, we were able to secure funding to increase safe routes to school programming and planning at Pimento Elementary School, and saw student walking and biking to and from school increase more than fourfold in 1 year alone. Sadly, similar efforts in South St. Cloud and a second elementary school in Sartell were not as fortunate, as the amount of funding available for these projects is not equal to the high demand of schools and municipalities. Therefore, not all of our students and families have the same opportunities to make healthy choices. The important call-out I want to mention here is that an investment by the state would help more of these local projects become reality rather than missed opportunities to improve health that won't see the light of day. As a healthcare provider, CentraCare Health supports active transportation policy solutions and comprehensive plans. Therefore, we feel it is critical that Minnesota make a commitment to transportation funding, which includes long-term sustainable funding for bike and walk community infrastructure. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Gertkin. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
1 second. Quorum is present. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my question. With a quorum present, now I do need to offer the A-15 amendment.
Great. Senator Peterson offers the A-15. Is it Mr. Oh. All right. We're looking for it. Oh. Senator Peterson, do you have a copy?
Yes.
And we can have copies made and distributed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Yep.
Maybe we can go to your other testifier. We'll have the copies made, and then we'll look at the amendment. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sanderson from Ottertail County, Peddle Fergus Falls.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Dave Sanderson. I'm a retired physician from Fergus Falls, and I'm also the co-chair of Peddle Fergus Falls, which is an advocacy group. And we have a mission of making biking and walking safe, fun, and easy for everyone in our community. When I worked as a physician, I was alarmed at the number of obese children I would see in the clinic. And over the years, the numbers increased dramatically to the point where childhood obesity has become an epidemic in our society. And obese children are at high risk of developing medical problems such as early onset diabetes. So exercise is extremely important, not only to treat, but to prevent obesity. So I would stress to parents the importance of their kids getting regular exercise, such as walking and biking to school. But I came to realize rather quickly that in Fergus Falls, our infrastructure is just not adequate to provide biking and walking for the kids. So I became a member of the Safe Routes to School Planning Committee, and we developed a wonderful plan, but unfortunately, because of a lack of resources, we haven't been able to implement that plan. And the legislature did allocate some funds, but they're just not enough. We really need more help so we can move forward with our plans. We also have a Bike and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, which is an official committee to the City of Fergus Falls. And one of our big tasks this year is to develop a Bike and Pedestrian Master Plan, which goes beyond the Safe Routes to School plan. And the goal is to improve our infrastructure so we can make it safe and convenient for people of all ages to bike and walk in Fergus Falls. Unfortunately, a lack of funding prevents us from doing these projects that are really important. And for example, we have a Lincoln Avenue bike trail that we've wanted to do for years. We just don't have the funding for it. So I think it's a high priority for Fergus Falls and other communities to become bicycle and pedestrian friendly. And There's so much to gain and so many benefits. For example, attracting and keeping young families in our communities, having a good business climate, strong economic development, and to create healthy communities where we can encourage everyone to be able to be active and do things like biking and walking. There are also some economic benefits. Studies have shown that people who are physically active use about $500 less per year of the healthcare services than somebody who's sedentary. So there are so many incentives to move forward. So in closing, I would just urge you to support Senate File 1376. Make the investment to help communities like Fergus Falls achieve these goals. And I think by doing so, you can create really vibrant, active, healthy communities throughout Minnesota. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Sanderson. Questions, members? All right. So I think we're still waiting for the copy of the amendment to come back. Do you want to describe it maybe and
sure.
preview it for us?
Sure. Before I move into the amendment, Mr. Chair, there's a couple notes, or I should direct your attention to handouts that you have in your packet there. One in particular you may find interesting is a graphic of a map that talks about the pedestrian and bicycle projects in Minnesota. Certainly it demonstrates how much work has been done, but then clearly demonstrates how much need there is around the state and desire there is really in all parts of Minnesota for funding for these types of projects. The amendment, the AE-15 amendment that is on its way here from the copy machine relates specifically to funding this bill. If you had a chance to review the bill ahead of time, you can notice that the funding is kind of left open in a number of areas, much like the Safe Routes to School is. So there's opportunities for a number of different funding mechanisms to be used as we move forward. What the A15 amendment does is specifically direct and fund this bill through the use of existing sales tax dollars on bicycles. So it would direct the Department of Revenue to transfer an estimate of the sales tax collected on bicycles to this fund, and then the intention would be to divide that by 50% to the two areas that are within the bill, 50% for Greater Minnesota and 50% for the metropolitan area, using that sales tax as a funding source at this point. So with that, I would encourage your support for the amendment.
Great. Thank you. And I think it has made its way around. Questions on the A15 amendment, members? Senator Peterson, do you have a sense of the revenue note, what the revenue note on this would be? I know it probably won't be generated until it makes its way to the tax committee, but do you have a general sense of orders of magnitude of how much this would direct to this fund?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, at this point we don't. I do need to apologize. The opportunity for this hearing came up fairly quick for us and have not been able to get that estimate yet from the Department of Revenue. But we would expect the opportunity to adjust that as we may need to, as we find out that information.
I know this has come up previously just based on, I couldn't even tell you, but I know that I've had conversations about this. I think this is an idea that has originated somewhere else in the legislature. And from my understanding, the advocacy community is not opposed to this idea. They're favorably disposed to this idea.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, they're more than welcome. Anybody is more than welcome to come up and speak for themselves, but my understanding is they're not. I have not talked to anybody that has advocated for the bill that's opposed to this.
In any case, this is an author's amendment, so all in favor of the A15, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Thank you. Anything further, Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair, members, if there's no further questions, I would just move the bill to Senate File 1376 to Transportation Finance.
As amended.
As amended, yep.
Oh, one moment.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's a little typo, Senator Peterson, on the A15. We'll just make that change just to be in good form here. Says change paragraph G to F, but down on 2.33, we'll just make that F a G H.
Okay. Then, yes, I see. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then we'll make the second F that's between parentheses later in that line H as well.
G.
I'm sorry, G. Excuse me, G. All right. Is that right? So H and G. So sub H for F and G for F in the second F. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no? Motion carries. All right. So to Senator Peterson's motion to move Senate File 1376 with recommendation to Transportation
Chairman.
Finance as amended. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Senator Peterson, how is this different than what we do today? I mean, like, if we're building a new road and we put in a bicycle lane alongside of it, or if we want to build a bike path or something, we just find some funding for it. How is this different than what actually is going on today?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, what the amendment and the bill, the amendment primarily now would designate funding for this project now, and then also make dollars available for new or additional bike paths that might not normally be accompanied in a road project.
But Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, so would it require that if there's a new road construction that there's a bike path along it, or does it I mean, it seems to me that if we're doing new road construction or if we're looking at doing a new bike path, that we have funding available for it and that we have that we dedicate money to the projects as they go. So does this make a new requirement? Is this a new mandate of some type or other?
Mr. Senator Chair Peterson. And Senator Tomasoni, this is not a new requirement. It just specifically provides a funding source for those projects as we move forward. So right now you may have heard of communities. In fact, I serve a community of St. Cloud who's adopted a complete streets policy. I guess I don't recall exactly what MnDOT has done on the state roads, but so, for example, within the city of St. Cloud, that type of policy would require room and paths for bicycles. And so right now I would say each community is making the decision on that themselves, depending on where the level of funding comes from, whether it's from the state, city, or township, municipality.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so then this will require that they do it, or this provides a funding source for them to do it, or this is a new funding source for
yes, Mr. Chair,
doing
members,
exactly what we're
this
doing
is
already.
A new
are we not doing this already? We're not doing this already. I mean, I know when I make right turns here in the Twin Cities, I cross over that bike lane, and I'm always wondering if I'm in an illegal lane or not. And so, I mean, is this something different than what we have already?
Who's our new
yes.
committee member?
I'm a transportation wannabe.
Yeah.
Always keeping an eye on me. Senator Tomasoni, I'll take a stab, and this doesn't require anything. It allows for communities to compete for a competitive grant program if they want to be including bike lanes, either as a part of a rebuild or they want to add bike lanes after the fact to an existing roadway system, existing roadway network. So this creates a pot of money, and then municipalities or counties or whomever can apply to that pot of money kind of on a competitive basis.
Okay,
is that accurate,
so,
Senator Peterson?
So that's not available to us now?
Kind of on a hit-or-miss basis, yeah. I mean, it is kind of, but it just creates a kind of more intentional approach to creating a pot of money. And part of part of the bill is Section 2 on page 4, you know, working with a whole bunch of stakeholders to develop evaluation and selection criteria and the like, you know, for the purpose of ranking and scoring these grants as these different communities make applications, and also making sure that if communities are going to be applying for these grants, that they're a function of a larger planning process. Senator Peterson, I'll just note, Council was talking in my ear, after we get to finance, we'll have to sort out just a little bit of detail around where these taxes would land, in there, because you set up three different funds, and it's not quite clear exactly how where these pots would, or where this money would land in those pots. So we'll just a little bit of verbiage that we need to add, but it's fine. We can work on it later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to contact Ms. Berezovsky in regard to that.
Great. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Peterson, would you go to line 2.24 on your amendment? Where it says, amongst other things, collected in a tax from the sale or purchase of bicycles. And I'm sitting here thinking, are we taxing the sale or the purchase, or is that the same? And maybe it's more of a question for Senate Counsel, but in other words, who pays the tax? And is that going to be confusing later on as we try to implement it? That's my question.
Thank you.
To me, Mr. Chair, Senator Peter, it's the sale that we're taxing, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum. You know, I did mark that here, and I'd be happy to check on that as well. The intent was, for the purchase, and, you know, as I worked with the reviser on this amendment, that's the language that they came for. I can't say I can speak directly to the state of mind of the reviser and why both the words sale and purchase are in there, but I will double-check and I'll add that to the list and work with Ms. Berezovsky on that as well.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, we don't need to solve it now. I looked at it, and I'm not sure I understood it. But, Mr. Chair, I would have one more.
Would
this be new and used bicycles? New for sure. Used as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, the intent is just new. Anything sold through a retailer, the intent would not be a private party. So potentially there could be a used bike sold through a retailer. And
sure.
The Department of Revenue would be estimating that dollar amount.
But Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, not neighbor to neighbor or friend to friend or...
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, no, that would not be the intent.
What about straw man sales?
Right.
And lastly, I think I know the answer to this, Senator Peterson. It doesn't cover, you know, a bike parts. If you buy a new seat, a new tire, a new headlight, or whatever else you might buy, it does not cover that, right?
No, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, it does not. But those are all great questions. I'll be sure to confirm that. In our discussions on that language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you.
Is it a new tax?
I'm sorry, Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, is it a new tax, or is it just taking money out of the general fund?
Senator Tomasoni, this would be existing tax.
Okay.
Right. So this will have to end up in the tax committee. Hope we're not setting a terrible precedent here. That's a foreshadowing of our larger transportation bill, but we'll see about that. All right, to Senate File 1376 as amended. Senator Peterson's motion. Anything else, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1376 or against? All right, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Peterson. Right. Senator Kent, back to 1108. So I will take Senate File 1108 from the table. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to reconnect us with where we left off last week, a reminder that there had been a task force examining the issue of uninsured motorists and ways to lower that rate. The Senate File 1108 is one of the main recommendations that came out of this task force. And just to clarify and remind everybody, the laws regarding motor vehicle insurance are not changing with this. The requirements to have insurance remain the same. The terms of when you have to demonstrate that insurance stay the same. And the need to show your proof of insurance if there's a traffic stop or if there's a crash, that remains the same as well. The only thing that is covered in the scope of this bill is that under current law, people, when they are registering a motor vehicle or re-registering or transferring ownership, instead of attesting that they have an insurance, which right now is done basically by checking a box and saying that you have it and signing it, now you will be required to provide three pieces of information that would demonstrate that you have insurance: the insurance company's name, the policy number, and the policy expiration date covering that vehicle. So that is the bill.
All right. Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and move the bill, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move Senate File 1108 be laid over for possible inclusion.
I think we have to send it to
Commerce. Oh, that's right.
Commerce.
Yes,
right.
Sorry. Yep.
Right.
I lost
Commerce.
Track myself.
All right. With recommendation. All right. Questions, members? Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, or Senator Kent, you referred to lower the rates of uninsured motorists. What is their percentages right now, and what do we think we'll get to?
Senator Kent.
The number that we're using is provided to us by the Insurance Research Council. They have a methodology for calculating that rate that they use across all 50 states, and they've used for a number of years, and that is estimated at 10.8% for Minnesota. The national average is 12.5%, and so that makes us, as I like to say, better than average. And to put this in context, the number one state in terms of the lowest rate of uninsured motorists is Massachusetts with 3.9%. And then it's like 26% in Oklahoma is the highest rate of uninsured motorists.
So, Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, Oklahoma, do they have a mandated policy like we have here in the state of Minnesota that you have to have insurance to drive?
Senator Kent.
I know our neighboring state, Wisconsin, used to not. Now, maybe they have in recent years, but
Mr. Chair,
comparing apples to apples?
Mr. Chair, Senator and Kent. Senator Westrom, Oklahoma does have a mandated insurance. I'm flipping through my notes real quickly to see. I think there are only three states that do not require motor insurance in the entire U.S., and in Oklahoma, they do, and they use one of the electronic verification processes, but that's fairly new for them. So they've not had a lot of time yet to see improvements in the results.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, Westrom. Senator Kent, you talked about the three things, the policy number, the expiration, and what was the third thing? And,
the
and then my question, the what?
The third thing is the insurance company name.
Insurance. So is that a form that you'll bring along, or... In our vehicle, we've got that little business-sized card that says that's what you give the officer if you'd get pulled over or if they want to check proof of insurance. It's that type of thing you'd have to bring in now along with your renewal?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Kent,
because of the nature of the options that we provide to Minnesotans to demonstrate, to register their vehicles or re-register their vehicles, they can do it online, they can do it by mail, or they can go to a deputy registrar's office. Because of the variety there, that's why it is the requirement is specified as those three pieces of information. Obviously, if you're sitting on your computer, you're not showing a card to anybody. You're putting in those three pieces of information. How somebody provides that information, if they show up at a counter, most likely, obviously, I would pull out my insurance card and read it right off of there. But that's why the statute specifies just providing the three kinds of information because of the variety of the ways that people register.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, if it's at your office, home office or your office, you can just take a notebook piece of paper, write down State Farm, for example, or Geico or somebody, write your policy number down, and if it expires tomorrow, you just write that date down, bring it in, and you get your tabs today.
Mr. Chair. Yes, that would count under the bill as it is proposed.
Okay, so
Senator West,
Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, what if your policy doesn't line up with the 12 months of tabs you're buying? And I guess my reluctance of your bill is to just make it more cumbersome for the 90% of the citizens that are already complying with the law, but maybe don't have a perfect record-keeping system in place. And so it's just one more thing. So I just want to make sure we're not going to now go down the road of your making sure your policy matches the 12 months that your tabs are being renewed, because most policies are on a different timeline, perhaps, than tab renewal.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, that is not in – there is no requirement that you demonstrate that your insurance aligns with your registration period. All it says is that you are providing the expiration date as of the time that you're doing the registration. You would not need to update that at any point during that registration period. Just when you renew a year later, you'll go through the same process and you'll have the new date at that point. The purpose here is, and there are a number of people who feel like, you know, this doesn't go far enough, that we should be having people have the opportunity to have this verified in a range of different ways. But this is the most reasonable next step in making sure that we are requiring people to follow the law that exists today, which is that you are supposed to carry valid insurance on a qualified motor vehicle. The other thing I would say, Senator Westrum, that was another part of the recommendations, which we're not doing in statute, but it is to have a public awareness campaign that accompanies this, that says that once we make this change, we are going to let people know, by the way, new rules in place. If you're thinking you're just going to come in and check a box and sign your name, you need to be prepared to provide this information when you come in now. And the idea here is, and we have seen this in other states, the awareness campaign itself has the effect of encouraging more people to comply with the law, which is to maintain current insurance. Once people realize that, yes, in fact, I am required to have the insurance and I am required to demonstrate it periodically, they actually do they get the insurance and they keep the insurance, which is the goal. That way people are properly covered and they are not transferring the financial responsibility of crashes, for example, onto somebody else.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Kent.
Senator Westrum.
Back to my first question. I mean, what is wrong with our current system? We're down to 10% uninsured, to 90% compliance. Are we going to get to 100% with this bill, or what do you reasonably expect, and what's wrong with the current system?
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, there is pretty widespread belief that we can do better than 10.8%, and 10.8% is not necessarily a perfect number. You know, we've looked at other states who've done some more detailed measuring that may be off by a couple of percentage points. There's no pretense here that we're going to get to 100%. Like I said, you know, a state like Massachusetts that has had a good track record for a long time, they're at about 4%. The question is, you know, what are reasonable enforcement mechanisms to ensure that people are following the law, that don't produce an undue burden, that don't create false positives, for example. We don't want to penalize somebody because of poor record keeping or something. But to do what we can from a policy standpoint to encourage citizens to do their share, to carry their insurance so that they maintain their obligation as a driver and a vehicle owner.
And so, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Westrum,
you talked about a public service campaign. How many dollars are we going to be putting into that, or how are we going to engage in a public service campaign to let people know that you now have to bring in different information than what you've done for years and years when you renew your tabs, which people can find to be a hassle? We just had a bill here a couple of weeks ago from one of your colleagues, our colleagues, with a constituent saying, let me renew for 3 years so I don't have to hassle this so often. How much money are we spending on this public service campaign?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Kent.
There is no appropriation for a public service campaign. The recommendation from the task force in terms of a statutory recommendation is what's in this bill.
Okay, so we'll have a public Senator service Westrom. Campaign with no money. Is that's what we're doing?
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair, the agencies involved would be doing their regular PR that they do in the course of their normal operations. They would just organize it and go out just as we do on a number of measures.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent, just to be clear on that point, so the agency already engages in some measure of public relations. This should just be one of the messages they fold into their regular program of public relations?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I see. Okay, thank you. Senator Westrom.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, as we're talking here, the thought striking me that I think your enforcement date or implementation date was January of next year. It almost strikes me as maybe a better campaign if we're going to pass this, and right now I'm not convinced that we probably should, but Senator Kent, maybe we push the enactment date out 2 years, during that two-year period, give people the option of which one they want to do a test or provide that information with the purpose of notifying them that by 2018, you will now have to do that so people can become ingrained in doing that rather than showing up, finding out that they don't have the information they need, and then have to drive back home. In a rural area, this is the reality. Many times, if you don't live in the county seat, you might drive 20 or 30 miles to get there. And I can assure you that I will have frustrated constituents that show up without the right information and then have to drive home, get it, and come back again. And so as I'm sitting here today, I will tell you that could be the scenario we're going to see, especially in rural areas, but even in metro areas. Not everybody lives exactly by the DMV site. And so at 10%, 90% compliance, and the best state out there is Massachusetts. I'm not sure we always want to be like Massachusetts, but I think we're doing a pretty darn good job with our current system.
Senator Westrom, they have a Republican governor.
What's that?
They have a Republican governor in Massachusetts.
Is that right?
Yes. Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I would just say that, you know, you are reflecting a lot of the conversation that happened in the task force, and people really sort of debated a lot of these different issues. There was a lot of time and thought spent by a bunch of really careful stakeholders representing a number of interests in this group, and this recommendation was seen as a very reasonable, modest approach towards a solution to lower the rate, protect Minnesota citizens who are law-abiding and do maintain their insurance so that the financial burden is not transferred onto them.
Yeah, put a price tag.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. As Senator Westrom suggested, as you all know, we send out a mailing that notifies you that your tabs need to be renewed. And so we usually do put important messages that we think that vehicle owners need to see on that notice. And so that would be one place that with some time and planning we would be able to do. And certainly the Department of Public Safety does have a lot of communications that we send out to try to address public safety issues. And so that having insurance, as was discussed by the task force, is something the task force members feel very strongly about, and certainly would be an issue of public safety in terms of having your vehicle insured when you're on the road.
Great. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, you know my concern about this in the past has been with those title transfers. I have a collector car, And the collector car, if I sell it, someone has to show insurance to be able to buy that car, even though it may not be driven on the street, and even though all insurance policies, all existing insurance policies of your cars are supposed to cover a new car for 14 days. So I can go and sell a car, buy a car. It is covered by some policy. Now, and I want to say that I'm absolutely in favor of making sure that people are insured, but there are some cases where the information that you're going to provide might not be considered even truthful. Because, for instance, on my collector car, I have insurance on it. I have a card for it. I have a glove box card, but it only covers comp, only the comprehensive part of it. But yet, my insurance agent, which I've had, I've had the same insurance agent for many, many years, and I've had the car for 45 years, I can call up that insurance agent and get insurance on it over the phone. And it all she does is to say I should quote my existing insurance policy, and then I can drive the car and I have the same insurance as one of my existing cars. So there's some areas there that I share Senator Westrom's mention of that hassle when you go and get your new tabs. If you don't have the information right with you, or if you haven't gone to your insurance agent and have gotten new insurance, you won't be able to transfer ownership. And that might be quite a challenge for somebody that isn't living near a deputy registrar.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
And Senator Carlson, just a reminder that the requirements for insurance are not changing under this bill. So if someone was required to have insurance in buying a collector car before this bill would pass, they would have the same requirement afterwards. The difference is in how they demonstrate it. And perhaps Ms. McCormick can talk some more about the specifics of how different types of vehicles are handled.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, as Senator Kent just stated, we're not going to be verifying the information on that, on your registration renewal form. We're not verifying it, but it is on record, and it will be something we do use. If you are cited for a violation, you're in a crash, you're in an accident, you're involved in some law enforcement action, that information will be used and then will be verified at that time. But we are not verifying the information except as necessary. If we need to verify it, then DVS has that information, and you would have to at least have a valid insurance policy, an insurance company, and the date your policy is in effect for. Those are the three items, and basically at this time the task force said, while we're reviewing whether or not we need a full verification system, which would do that if the DVS eventually would design and implement an electronic verification system, that would be done right at the point of contact. But at this time, it will be on the record so that we can verify it, and we do, DVS does verify it depending on crashes, depending on violations, and so that would be what that information would be for. And the task force felt that this was a first step in trying to educate the public that they really do need to buy and keep insurance on their vehicle at all times that they're driving that vehicle.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, just for clarification, there are those five types of vehicles that you don't renew your license, and so you don't even have a record of DVS wouldn't have a record of any insurance policy relating to those cars. If I would be driving it, I'm assuming that my insurance policy number would change. And then also, for instance, I just changed all of my insurance policies, so all of those that I may have given before are now obsolete. All that information is obsolete. So I guess I'm, I want to I want to find a reason to support this, but what I do is I see a lot of extra paperwork and extra effort that doesn't necessarily pay off to encouraging people to make sure that they have insurance.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, the only thing I would say to that is that our staff do verify at times of crashes, serious violations. We call the insurance. We don't call an insurance agent. We call the insurance company. And so if it wasn't listed under that policy, if there was a different policy, and we have your name and address and the vehicle and the VIN number, then that would be how that would be located in terms of whether you had insurance on that vehicle.
And, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Kent.
And the difference between the way things are now and the way things would be under this bill is if someone has attested at the time that they register their vehicle that they have insurance, and then 6 months later they end up in a crash and somebody goes back and verifies and it turns out that they actually did not have insurance at the time that they attested that they did, there's a problem and a fine for that. So this is just one additional layer of checking, one step beyond attesting, because right now people are swearing legally that they have insurance when they check that box and sign their name. And, you know, then they drive off and everything's fine until something happens and then it turns out that they didn't. And then they have a legal problem. Same thing here. You know, they're providing this information. It is one more screen that provides a little bit more of a hurdle and a check than just checking a box and signing your name. So for those who do maintain insurance, they can just fill that information in. But the idea is to, you know, again, it comes back to this notion. And this was something that the task force spent a lot of time discussing and examining, both within our state, but then looking around the rest of the country, the issue of an unfair transfer of burden. Those who follow the law and maintain their insurance, pay their bills, law-abiding citizens, and then those who might not be. And it shifts the burden if somebody's not doing their fair share. That's why we have the law. And if we're going to have the law, are we going to enforce it? This is just taking one more step to make sure we're enforcing the law.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, you said before it doesn't change anything, but it does change the fact that now if you have a classic car, you have to provide an insurance policy to change ownership. You didn't before. You could attest, for instance. I could attest because my classic car has insurance on it, but it isn't liability. It doesn't give any protection whatsoever. But and also, when you say you can apply for a transfer, apply for new licenses, you might attest that you have insurance at that moment. You might even put a insurance policy down, a number down at that moment. But 2 weeks later, you can cancel it. So I'm not sure that this gets to where you really want to be.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson,
Senator Kent.
And the task force would agree with you, you know, that this does not get us, as many people think, this does not go far enough. But, you know, for a variety of technical reasons, it's not something that we can do more ambitiously right now. Again, there, you know, the requirements about insurance are not changing. If you are driving a car that needs to be insured, you will still need to be insured in the future. It's just a matter of how you are legally providing information that you have the insurance that you're required to have. And when it becomes a problem, frankly, is if there is a crash or an incident that will get people investigating whether or not you were being honest at the time.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Kent, thank you for your work on this issue. It did come out of a task force, and I know you put in a lot of time. One thing that I want to talk about a little bit is as an insurance agent that has to deal with people that get a citation for not having insurance, there is a lot of pressure for them to come to us and have us just get them insurance. So that's one issue. But what this is trying to get at is people are making the assumption that I'll just go ahead and attest, even, you know, whether or not you do, and hope you don't get stopped. Once I get stopped, then I'll deal with it then. We want people to think about it in advance all the time and at a point where public safety can say, you're getting your registration, don't forget your insurance verification. And insurance verification would be the proof and verification, meaning the policy, the company, just how it's laid out here, before you get stopped. We want to move that train of thought to that point, not at the point of a stop or a violation or an accident, which is what happens. So I really do appreciate the work on this. I support this wholeheartedly. We have to figure out this doesn't solve everything. And if we had a system that could electronically verify, I don't even know if that would have came out of the task force. But I know you put in a lot of time and a lot of effort. And hopefully what this will do is get to some of the marketing that Senator Westrom was talking about without actually having to put it out without an action from the consumer. Because without an action from the consumer, they're really not going to pay as much attention still. So.
Great. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, was it the opinion of your task force that this measure, this change, would reduce insurance rates for the consumer?
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, there was a lot of discussion about that. I think the sort of consensus is that it might not result in direct reductions, but it might minimize future increases. It was sort of the best guidance that we got from the insurance industry in terms of experiences in other states. So it over time will hopefully be part of, and you know, Senator Jensen and I have been working on other insurance reform measures as well that are all designed exactly to that, to try to keep insurance costs down for consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, that would be my view as well, or my opinion. And then Ms. McCormick, you know, I'm familiar with the checklists that show up when you do your tabs by mail and certainly online, and when they're notified. Could you give us a brief description of how you might change that checklist to communicate this change to consumers?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, we really haven't gotten into discussions as to those details, but certainly we can apprise the committee of what our plans are as we move. If this legislation passes and is enacted into law, we certainly would be willing to share all that information. It would be part of the campaign, I would assume, anyway. So,
all right.
So,
thank you.
Senator Peterson, are you referring to when you go to renew, there's a little sheet that says, don't forget this, don't forget this, don't forget this, and beyond that, you're hoping it would be on that list of things that someone who's going to renew their tabs would be alerted to.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick, that's my intent. I don't view that as a real big obstacle. I think of most recently, the one I've seen recently is when you renew tabs by mail, right on the exterior of the envelope, it says, before you seal this envelope, do not do these things. And one of those, you know, in my view, should be include a copy of your insurance card. It's not a real difficult thing that we're asking folks to do, in my view, in hopes of reducing insurance rates long term. So,
all right.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Anything further, committee? Would anyone? Oh, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. McCormick can give me a percentage to the question I had asked Senator Kent. We're at about 90% compliance with the attestation process that we have right now. A lot of our laws are predicated on honesty, and if people are going to lie or say something different, gets them in trouble down the road. But until they get caught in a lot of things, it's not it's the way we have an efficient system, if you will. We're at about 10% noncompliance now. What number do you think we're going to get to with this bill?
Senator Ms. McCormick.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, I would agree with what Senator Kent said, because we had discussions with about 10 different states, I'd say, and I think all of them were surprised at whether they did have significant change or whether they didn't have significant change, because they all had worked really hard to implement a program and a public relations campaign. And it's just hard to tell how that will be reacted to. But we believe that you know, this is one step to take to see if it does make an improvement, and that will, I think, be part of what will be looked at in terms of whether a verification system or some other process would be used. I thought the task force wanted to take steps incrementally and assess them as we go forward.
And, Mr. Chair?
Senator Kent.
If I can just add to that, two things. I agree with Ms. McCormick in terms of the task force's approach, and it was, you know, what are some of the least intrusive, least costly both to the state and then also to citizens, steps we can take to do a little more in terms of checking and making sure people are abiding by the law. When you look at some of these programs that different states are embarking on, these get really expensive. I mean, it can be, you know, computer programs in every single law enforcement vehicle, and they're checking them on the street. There are a number of things that can get really expensive really fast. And so that's why, you know, I feel like this is a very modest, reasonable step to sort of assess what happens. The other thing I would refer to from what I had mentioned last week, it happened that my husband and I were living in Texas. He was working there at the time when Texas began this process over 20 years ago. And I think their uninsured motorist rate at the time was over 20, close to 25%. And if you look at the map that's included in the full report that was given out last week, Texas is now at 13.3%. In recent years, they've implemented one of these more aggressive electronic verification programs. But it is a real change in mindset and culture in the state because, you know, compliance was really optional in terms of a mindset prior to enacting that. And when they did it, it was, you know, it of course, anytime you change expectations of citizens, you know, they may have some resistance to it, but they understand that ultimately, whether it's saving them costs or not unfairly transferring a burden, they appreciate why it's being done. And over time, it just became no big deal to bring your insurance information in to change your, to update your registration.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Kent and Ms. McCormick, thanks for your answer, but I think it still begs the question for the need for this bill, just because the task force reviews it. I'm not hearing any numbers. The numbers you just heard from Texas, we're still ahead of Texas, and they've got this system in place. And so I think maybe the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You're not going to get to zero, whether you put this in place or not. I just can assure you, you won't get to zero because that's just the way society is. I think you've got human beings we're dealing with, and Massachusetts isn't even at zero from the sounds of it. But how do we measure if this is the right direction or not? I mean, if it's going to get us down to 4%, then it might be a laudable goal. But we're already in the top percentages of compliance already with the current system. So I think it's a I'm not sure. I'm not convinced of the need to make this change to go to somewhere where we're already in the top tier of already. I just don't see the need for it. I was hoping there was more thought going into and proof of these other 10 states that's going to get us 5 or 6% better, but at the inconvenience of the 90% that are complying with it already.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
I would just remind the committee that there was a lot of thought on the part of a lot of dedicated task force members in looking at this information and looking at the experience of a number of states and then looking at the options.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Kent and probably Ms. McCormick, I have two questions about the number, the 90%. Does this actually include those who are ineligible to buy insurance because they don't have a driver's license, for instance? And do you have any breakdown of those numbers? Because that's a different situation than someone just being eligible for insurance but not having it. And then also, how about those that had their insurance canceled because of driving behavior? Are we looking at those as a separate breakdown, and are they part of this 10%?
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, Kent. Just a reminder from our presentation about the task force work from last week. The reality is there is not a lot of data on this issue.
And that is a frustration. That's both nationwide and in the state of Minnesota. As I mentioned, and this is in the full report that everybody received, the Insurance Research Council's data, which is particularly useful because it's the same methodology that is used across all 50 states, so that you can do some comparisons about different approaches and different results, also over time, so that you can look at trends. So the methodology has stayed constant over a number of years, and you can look at trends, and we can evaluate success over time. But it is a ratio of uninsured motorist claim frequency to bodily injury claim frequency. There are questions about that methodology, but it is definitely the best one we have. That's why I say, you know, it's give or take a couple few percentage points when we look at other states who have done their own research and compared that to the IRC number. But this is the most useful number we have. But no, it does not get down into the breakdown. And that is exactly the point. There is a lot of energy in trying to do something more ambitious and more aggressive and more costly. And the exact point from the task force is basically, without better data to better target our efforts, you can't really justify a more ambitious approach. That is why this is being proposed by the task force and in this legislation as a modest, reasonable approach to try to bring that number down and make sure that we are not unfairly transferring the burden to law-abiding citizens.
Yeah.
Senator Carlson.
And just a short follow-up. I'm on the bill to try to help people get driver's license so that they can qualify for insurance, and I'm hoping that just being able to buy insurance is going to change that number also. So I applaud what you're doing. And I believe the data that you've gotten is from stop data and crash data. Isn't that the origin of it?
I have to say,
Senator Kent,
off the top of my head, I don't know. I don't have those details in front of me in terms of the methodology. I quoted to you the exact formula. So how they arrive at those numbers, I can't answer that right now.
All right. Any further committee? Would anyone else like to – did I already ask? Did I call for testimony? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1108? For or against? No. All right. On Senator Kent's motion to refer Senate File 1108 with recommendation to the Committee on Commerce, all in favor say aye.
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 No?
No. Motion passes. Senator Kent, we're actually going to jump to Senator Herr's bill. Is it – hopefully is a short – never know with this committee, but it seems like it's will be a slightly shorter bill, and I suspect 1393 will be a slightly longer conversation. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you. Appreciate Senator Kent for allowing me to insert in this time. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1128 on Jake Brake, or engine brake, but more precisely on neighborhood noise concern created by Jake Brake. Jake Brake is a mechanical operation on semi-truck that allows compression engine to slow down the vehicle. By doing that, it makes a long rattling noise that hurts the ear, and it not only causes tremor on nearby homes, but it has broken glass windows. This noise is referred by auto professional to as machine gun noise. This is a perfect time for me to and the committee to hear this bill, and I really appreciate it because, one, it's because we just took a transportation tour through my district, and some of you have a good idea of the location this bill is talking about. Two, due to the capital renovation, we have experienced similar noise disturbance as neighborhood along I-94 on my district, but in a smaller scale. So when our table here at the Senate starts shaking due to construction outside, just imagine several times louder and heavier. That is what my constituent has endured all these years. And all it takes is putting a sign, a no Jake Brake, on the stretch of highway to get the cooperation of truck drivers. I did some research and found out that such law already exists in our state, passed in 2008 by a wildlife senator named Scott Dibble, because the cross jurisdiction between state highway and city zoning, there's a twist and turn process that needs to be done before the city can put out a sign. First of all, we must have a letter of intent or a resolution from the city, and I have a copy here to show you that we do have a resolution from the city of St. Paul. then a bill must be heard and passed by the legislature, as I am doing now. Once we have the support of the legislature, this bill will authorize city to pursue the test of putting the no Jake Brake sign alike to the one that I passed it out to on the appropriate area through a city ordinance. Member, I ask for your support of this bill, Senate File 1128, for some comfort of resident along 94. And I will be here to answer any question. I also have Mr. Bob Parker, who brought this to my attention, a resident just next to the highway, and you know, our Eastside activists and, you know, community leaders, Mr. Tom Dyson. So if you have any question after their, you know, I appreciate after their testimony, please ask us. So Mr. Bart Parker, you want to go ahead first?
Mr. Parker.
Thank you for having me here. For 15 years, I've lived in Dayton's Bluff, and I live fairly close to the highway, so I understand that there's going to be some noise, but the trucks as they approach downtown St. Paul are generally going over the speed limit. I mean, that's anecdotal, but there's the grade turns to the right and goes downward, and in order to slow down from 70 miles an hour or even 65, they use engine braking, and the decibel level is incredible. During heavier times of traffic, you know, of course, it's going to be really bad, but even in during the night or early morning, the windows will rattle. Most noise is due to the heavier traffic schedules, but this is unnecessary. It's woken me up, you know, lots of times, but noise is a huge quality of life issue, and on the east side of St. Paul, we have to work for every bit of our quality of life. A lot of municipalities enforce this ordinance and post it as you enter their borders. I think Minneapolis is one of them. And it'd be an important and appreciated step forward if we could just make this step towards returning some quality of life to the east side. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Tom Diamond, St. Paul. This neighborhood, Dayton's Bluff, there's been a tremendous amount of revitalization in this neighborhood. It's a beautiful neighborhood sitting on the River Bluff, overlooking this capital, downtown St. Paul, and the Mississippi River. The noise problem has become so great, it has become very difficult for people to live in this wonderful community and all the effort they've put into revitalizing this area. The suggestion of MnDOT, one of the suggestions was, well, we'll just build a wall across in front of the neighborhood. You can imagine the impact where no longer can you see the capital, the downtown, the river, and the impact on it. That's not a reasonable action to correct this issue. The neighborhood has invested heavily into this. The legislature has invested heavily into this. We were able to get, with your assistance, we were able to get Metro U on this site and have developed a beautiful campus. We've got the wonderful science building that's going up now that overlooks this. And we also have the Bruce Vento Nature Sanctuary that runs along to it. So your help on this issue will really go a long way to help this neighborhood and help the efforts that you have played a significant role in making a difference on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. And as your neighbor to the east in Woodbury, I know exactly where you're talking about, and I appreciate the concern. Senator Herr, was there any additional commentary you wanted to add at this point?
Well, again, this is the process of city and highway judicial. It's a twist and turn process, and you know, we have to go through this process. So mainly I just want your confirmation to support this bill, and it will pass, and we will authorize the city to carry out the mission of putting up the sign. It seems easy, but this is the process of our government.
Thank you, Senator Herr. Senator Kiffmeyer, then Newman, then Westrum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Herr, this seems like, you know, just a noise thing. So they can stop their trucks. They can do everything that they need to do. It's just that this one particular noisy way in this area, not. if it enables you to still function safely, then do without the noise.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Kittmeyer.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Herr, essentially two questions. One is a follow-up on Senator Kiffmeyer. Have you heard from any groups, say MnDOT or the Trucking Association or anyone else that has indicated that because you're coming from the River Bluff into the downtown area, you're going downhill, that the elimination of the ability to use the subject brake or braking system would be a safety hazard?
No, Senator Newman, I have not heard on that, but I know that the speed limit on that section of the highway is 55 miles per hour, and there may be time when truck driver go past that limit. Maybe Mr. Tom Diamond may have the more direct answer.
I may be able to answer that a little bit because I'm actually have my semi-license. And the reason why braking is done in that way normally is because it saves on the brakes themselves. And so some brakers use that technique to save on brakes. And so the question is, are we going to save on brakes, or are we going to provide some peace and livability to the community?
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer, and I think what I heard was, no, you haven't heard from any organizations that has indicated to you that this is a safety issue, and your answer is fine. The other question I have then, it would be, what is the penalty for violation that would be imposed on the truckers?
There will not be any penalty. It's just to get cooperation of a truck driver, letting them know that the neighborhood, the residential, prefer to not to use Jake brake, and they could use the conventional brake, the surface brake, as I refer to, or they can just slow down. There's many options. They can slow down without using the brake, or just use a gear. If the truck is geared, they can just pull a lower gear, and that will avoid using Jake brake, because Jake brake is very disturbing. It just automatically pops with the decibel, and it's startling.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
So as I understand, Senator Herr, then that this would be, I'm guessing, would be a violation of an ordinance that the city is going to, of St. Paul, would put in place, and the penalty for the trucker who would violate that ordinance would not even be a petty, which would cost him, say, a $100 fine. There is not going to be any fine or anything like that. Is that what you're saying?
I suppose there's more in-depth research into that part of passing the city ordinance. But the thing is, if we commission Highway Patrol to go after everybody with noise, we're gonna misuse our resource. But I think right now it's just to get cooperation, and the bill is mainly focused on get cooperation of the truck driver. And truck driver are very, I would say, very sincere. Sometimes if they sign that notify them that the neighbors are concerned, they will cooperate. Truck driver are as Mr. Tom Diamond can be testimony to this, truck driver are very skilled driver and very cordial to and respectful to resident. And I'm sure if they see a sign like this on the highway, they will slow down and follow the rule.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Senator Herr, the reason I'm asking is specifically you're getting into an area where the ordinance potentially could affect the ability of a truck driver to earn a living because they need a special license. And so, I think I am hearing that you want the cooperation of the truck driving industry and the truck drivers, and you're not doing it for the purpose of implementing penalties such as fines or the loss of license, but the possibility would be there. Am I correct?
That's Senator. Correct. And that, if we put on penalty, that would be a different bill. This bill mainly just to get the confirmation from the legislature and our committee here so that the city can move on with the process of putting up a sign.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Newman. Senator Wester.
Madam Chair, a few questions just for your information. But, Madam Chair, before I ask, is the Truckers Association here or would they have somebody that is planning to testify or could testify? I'd like to have them do that.
Senator Westrom, the Truckers Association has not indicated any interest, and I'm not seeing anybody come forward.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Herr, to Senator Newman's point, what is prohibiting the city from implementing an ordinance with a penalty? I'll reread it here, but I didn't see that in the first my glimpse of the read. But you're saying there would be no penalty to the truck drivers, but it'd be basically warning tickets issued and a sign erected, and hopefully the sign itself will be the thing that tells people, please don't use your Jake brake in this area.
Senator Herr.
Senator Westrom, I appreciate your question. I would say I don't know the detail of the specific detail of all the state law and the city law, how intertwined with each other, and I will be happy to provide you that information later. The intent of this bill is just to give an on switch so that we can move on allowing the city to put a sign, and the city will look carefully, you know, on their own jurisdiction to see if where it will be appropriate to put that sign. And so could this law, this bill that governed the whole state of Minnesota in regarding to Jake Brake, is already passed in 2008, and the implication of that is very complicated. It will take some time just to skim through and look at every dot or every language it is, but I'm just restate again, the intent of this bill is just to get legislation confirmation so we can let the city move on with their tests.
So Senator Herr, to that point, would you be open then to clarifying language that allows them to adopt an ordinance but no penalties assessed? Because I think Senator Newman's point, truck drivers in the recent decades have gone under a lot more scrutiny. To get a CDL is a harder thing, but a serious scenario. And let me share a story with you from one of my constituents who got a ticket out in Wyoming, and by the reason of practicality could not fight it, although the reason the officer cited him was he thought he was not cooperating or being a nuisance to the person, the truck in front of him, and all he was doing was pulling out to see if he could pass, and then he'd pull back in, and there was reasons that he got a citation over it. But the long story short is he told me, he says, finally I couldn't, it didn't pay to go fight it, but now it's on my record. By not fighting it, it's caused him problems to being able to keep his CDL because they can't have very many citations on their license, and they all of a sudden lose their right to earn a living, as Senator Newman talked about. And so I would be concerned, but would you be open to that type of a language to clarify that if needed?
Senator Herr.
Senator Westrom, you know, I appreciate your suggestion, but each city have different way of managing their road and bridges, and that would be vary from the answer would be each city it will vary from city to city of whether they want to put that into the ordinance or not. And this our state law already granted the application of Jake Brake. So if there has been problem, we already heard from the trucking industry that Jake Brake, no Jake Brake posed a difficulty for them. So it has been appeared to 6 years now that we have not heard any complaint from the trucking industry. So I don't see much complaint from this point on if we just authorize the city, only the city of St. Paul, and only on a stretch of I-94 from Johnson Parkway to Highway 52, only that area. You know, that's what the intent of this bill is.
And Mr. Chair, Senator
Herr,
about how many miles are we talking in that area?
About one mile.
So
Senator Westrum.
To Mr. Chair, one of your testifiers talked about the Metro State Campus and the Nature Conservancy or a nature center there. Is the environment we're trying to protect? And what else is in the neighborhood? Is it for those areas that we're trying to stop this, or for residents that live along the highway? And how many are we talking about?
Senator Hurd.
I can look at the population. The most important thing is the resident that lives in the neighborhood, and that's why Mr. Parker, who lived there for years, had been struggling with this issue. And I think lowering the noise down will really, give a lot of comfort for neighbors in that area. So the top priority is to suit the neighborhood's need.
And Mr. Senator Chair, Senator Hur, I speak from a little experience because I actually used to live for a long time right along a main highway, U.S. Federal Highway 59, which comes through our local town. And, of course, after I bought the house, then I realized what happens at 2 and 3 in the morning when the trucks come into town, because I was near the edge of town. And I wasn't probably more than 30 feet from the street with the house. And you know where my bedroom was on the street side of the house. So I know what you're talking about here, but I don't know that the legislature putting a patchwork of no Jake break use is the right answer here. In my own case, I just turned on a fan and muffled the noise that way. And so I'm wondering if there's a different way that we could deal with this than just implement patchwork of no Jake breaks. How many other places in our state do we have this? Do you know?
Senator Hur. I don't have the answer for you now. I know that in the city of Minneapolis, there's some stretch that require
just Minneapolis at this point?
At this point, as far as I know. But perhaps the council, if they know, they can chime in. And Senator Westrum, if I may, if noise, similar noise like this, is a distraction to you living near the highway, I would suggest that you also approach your city, and then the city will bring a legislation up similar to what I'm doing now.
I fixed Senator the problem myself.
Okay.
Senator Westrum, I don't know how many locations there are around the state. I have seen the same admonition or sign coming into a number of communities off of the county road and trunk highway system, but council has a response.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, it's my understanding that municipalities can regulate this type of engine braking on most on city streets or on county highways and that type of thing, or probably on trunk highways too, but I was advised by MnDOT that because the regulation would be on an interstate, that for a city to be burdening traffic on an interstate with an ordinance, that it would require or suggest legislative authorization for adoption of the ordinance. Mm-hmm. So there could be other, at other levels of roadway, there could be restrictions on braking. But the only other one that has been authorized by the legislature was for Minneapolis, a stretch on I-394.
A bill that the chair of this committee passed a few years ago.
Mr. Chair, I wonder, kind of reminds me of the freeway that has a speed limit that's different than most freeways. That's a little of the patchwork that we might be looking at here. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Hur, I don't like to not support your bills. At this time, I'm concerned about that. I'd like to continue to talk to you about my concerns, if this is the right way, and Senator Newman, I think, raised some good points because, I come from an area where a lot of people truck drive to make a good living, but it means you've got to be gone from your family a long time, and, these semis, it used to be that they have to flip the Jake brake every time they were coming into town. You know, automation, technology, most of the time these semis have Jake brakes on all the time. So when they start braking, it, to your testifier, he's right. It saves brake pads, and they're not cheap to fix. I've got family members that have truck drive. I've got friends that truck drive, and it's very expensive to keep up their rigs. And so it could be very inadvertent that they just drive automatically with these on and coming into your town, and then getting a penalty and a citation out of it would be a genuine concern I have. And so I'd like to talk to you further about that.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Westrom. I hear your concern, and perhaps you and I can have, you know, a discussion outside this committee about that. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps more so just to the committee and perhaps a little bit of a voice of sarcasm, but I'm thinking about this, and why would a truck need to slow down coming in from the east side and into St. Paul? It's because they have to slow down because they have to route or be routed through downtown St. Paul. And in this case, we satisfy the Dayton's Bluff people, but the people on, if you will, Summit Hill, who don't let trucks go by their freeway and don't let cars go over 45 miles an hour, they're held harmless because we route all the trucks down 7th Street. So that's the reason they have to Jake brake coming down the hill on the east side. They have to slow down to go down through downtown St. Paul. Ooh. So a little bit of sarcasm, but I think it's real.
Yeah, and
do I have an amendment?
thank you, Senator.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, sarcastically, Senator Sanchem is getting to my question. What are the alternatives to this method of slowing down? And is there a safety concern? That's why I think, like Senator Westrom, I would have liked somebody from the Truckers Association to be here. And do you know what those other options are?
If I can defer this question to Mr. Tom Diamond, who is also a licensed truck driver, and I don't know where he get his license from. But there is a truck driving school near where he lived too in the area as well. But Mr. Tom Diamond,
I don't want to speak for the truckers or the trucking association, but I am informed that they have no particular objection to this bill, given the geography of that particular area. The alternative is, you know, flipping off the engine braking system and just using the full braking system, which is quieter than the, you know, the staccato pneumatic system that slows down the engine that creates the drag that slows the vehicle down. I'll also say, while I have the microphone, I learned this when I had my bill, Jake Brake is a particular name of a particular product by a particular company. The term that will appear on the sign will not be Jake braking, because that's a specific system that's sold by a particular company. It would be engine braking would be the term of art. Mr. Diamond.
Just briefly to follow up on that, it's not a safety issue.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
And I imagine it's a lot like Kleenex, Mr. Chair. It just becomes part of the vernacular.
Exactly, or Senator Kent would say it's like Coke in the South. I'll have a Coke. What kind of Coke? Orange. 7-Up. All right, anything further, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1128? Oh, Senator Hur, do you have an amendment?
Yes. We'll just keep the bill as it is.
All right. Yeah. Very good. So Senator Kent moves. Senate File 1128 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Any questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Hur. And we're back to Senator Kent, Senate File 1393.
I'm going to get the author to, yeah. So,
is cold, and they're going to have to warm up now.
Thank you.
This is a Kent bill. This is
back up to here because I had to do
1393.
So do we have a, we could have a page come to the table for some handouts, it looks like, or to the witness table. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Now I'm ready to talk about Senate File 1393. This is a bill that was brought to me by MnDOT, and it is an extension of a work zone safety bill that we passed last year in 2014 that is in the process of being enacted. Senate File 1393 would allow a peace officer to issue a citation to the driver of a vehicle within 4 hours if the peace officer has probable cause to believe that the driver violated a flagger's direction. Flaggers are the most vulnerable of workers in highway work zones. A driver not following a flagger's direction can result in a head-on crash or an intrusion into an active work zone, posing a danger to the lives of both workers and the vehicle occupants. If drivers were to understand that a flagger can report the violation to a peace officer and the driver could be cited afterwards, then there might be fewer violations. Similar law exists for drivers who ignore a school bus stop arm. And it is worth reiterating, that is what a lot of what this is modeled on. This legislation is needed to improve safeties for flaggers within the highway work zones. Flaggers have reported that since a violation currently needs to be witnessed by a peace officer for a citation, there have been cases when drivers just ignored the handheld stop sign. The goal is to improve safety for flaggers, the motoring public, and other workers downstream of the flagging operation. We can all imagine when you have a two-lane situation and you've got one lane blocked off and everybody has to take turns sharing the lane, that can create a real hazard for everybody involved. The improved safety would be accomplished in part by raising awareness of the seriousness of disobeying a flagger. Each year, MnDOT reviews work zone safety with field personnel. Drivers endangering flaggers and other workers by being inattentive to the roadway environment and the directions of the flagger are reported frequent occurrences. Field personnel also often report having to jump out of the way of approaching vehicles. During the past 10 years, there have been 65 fatal crashes, resulting in 83 deaths in work zones and a total of 17,731 crashes in work zones. Included in this total are 173 serious injury crashes. And beyond this very critical public safety aspect, there is a cost consideration. MnDOT uses the following crash costs. Fatal injuries account for over $10 million in costs. The most serious injuries, $550,000. All the way down to property damage only, $7,400. Reduction in fatal and serious injury crashes is a cost savings to MnDOT, society, and employers who see lost productivity and medical expenses due to an employee being injured or killed in a crash. This law would reduce the need to have police on site, another cost, to witness the violation and free them up for other enforcement activities. So ultimately, there are cost savings here, and ultimately it helps keep workers who are doing a tremendous public service safe, and other drivers as well. With that, I would like to introduce Ken Johnson from the Department of Transportation Office of Traffic Safety.
Senator Kent, those statistics you cited were just for the state of Minnesota?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ken Johnson. I'm the State Work Zone Pavement Marking and Traffic Devices Engineer out of the MnDOT Office of Traffic Safety and Technology. I chair committees that hear from flaggers who report that it's essentially a daily occurrence where drivers willfully disobey the flagger paddle. It's a stop paddle. It's a stop sign on the paddle. And we hear that drivers will disobey either in distraction or willfully ignoring the paddle. They say, we have examples where people just willfully ignore it and just go on into the work zone, which leads to some serious issues. You're heading into head-on traffic, or you're heading into the work zone where you're putting workers' lives at risk. Even if you are heading into the lane that's open, at some point you are likely to run into the traffic that's coming towards you, leading to a possible intrusion of that work zone. And that can have some severe consequences. With it, with you are some pictures of a situation. It was a flagging operation where it was a rear-end crash at the back of the queue. So these are the people who were waiting for the flagger direction to go ahead, but a semi-truck ended up ignoring and not paying attention, distracted or whatever reason, and ended up running into a few vehicles. This is an end-of-queue crash, not necessarily directly related to ignoring a flagger, but it's a good example of what can occur with high-speed traffic on our two-lane, two-way roads. Also, as a handout, I've handed out the flagging handbook. This is a document. All flaggers in the state are required to follow that document because it's part of the Minnesota Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices. On the state highway system, all flaggers are required to be trained before they're even allowed to be out there. If we were to have success with this, MnDOT will add to the flagger training appropriate reporting procedures after consultation with the state patrol. Also within this manual, I just wanted to point out a couple of key things. On page one, it talks about the tools. The paddle that's getting used has a stop sign on it, and it has a slow sign on the other side. So it's a stop sign that is being ignored by the driver when they bypass it. In addition, on page four is an indication of what the layout ought to be when a flagger is doing work. What this does not show is that there are signs prior to that saying road work ahead and one lane road ahead. And there often might be prepared to stop. So it should not be a surprise to drivers when they're coming up to a work zone like this. In closing, I ask that you pass this bill to improve flagger safety. When drivers understand that there's a consequence to violating the flagger stop paddle, even if a police officer didn't witness it, then we expect better compliance to the flagger stop paddle. With me are flaggers who can testify on what they've actually seen in the field.
Mr. Chair, before we would do that, I apologize. I forgot to bring up an author's amendment, if I may. This is
sure,
the first
absolutely.
Stop. I have the A1 amendment.
Senator Kent offers the A1 amendment.
It's clarifying.
That'll come around. We'll wait till that gets distributed before we take an action on it. All right. On the A1 author's amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Are you Mr. Streeter? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you.
My name is Ron Steele. I work for MnDOT.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
I don't know if you guys have a picture up there or not of an accident. Did they pass that around? Thank you. I was involved in that. I was actually the flagger there at that time. He was a truck driver. He did not obey any of the signs. I had three vehicles in front of me, and he hit all three vehicles, one of which took the glove off my hand, another one that I bounced off of. I wasn't injured. I was lucky. Everybody in the work zone didn't realize that. They didn't think I was there anymore. One of the women in the white car that they got shown there, that's where my glove was. My lunchbox was actually in that fifth-wheel pickup camper. I helped the truck driver out of his truck. I helped the mail that was in that truck out of the truck. The white car actually went through that camper before it hit the other vehicles in front of it. Now, that truck driver did not know what was going on. He never said if he fell asleep. He did not know anybody was stopped in front of him. We had four signs that day to warn him with plenty of distance. I think it speaks to public awareness that it's a dangerous job, and whether it be willful disregard or just inattentiveness, kind of like the seatbelt laws, DWI laws, move over laws, they've all increased public safety, and I think that's what this would do as well.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story. Questions, members? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, just kind of a broader question. Right now we have a witness by a police officer standard. We deviate from that on school bus, ignoring school bus stop arms. Is there any other place we do that? And what's the slippery slope, if you will, or the rationale for wanting police officers to at least witness a violation versus trusting somebody in the public? And Senator Kent, any comments or discussions you've had with the proposers of this or people that might raise those types of concerns?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
And Senator Westrom, my understanding, and I'm looking at counsel to see if she has any, if she's going to contradict me, but that school buses is the other example of this. And there's a similarity here that, you know, people are sort of uniquely vulnerable in those moments, whether it's school children crossing a street or if it's workers standing there in front of moving traffic asking them to obey stop signs. And so that's what's comparable about these situations that is different than other types of traffic situations. If Ms. Berezovsky has any additional information.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, there are two places in the traffic regulations chapter that I know of that have that four-hour provision or a similar four-hour provision. And as Senator Kent said, one is for school bus, for driving around a school bus violation, and the other one is moving over for a parked emergency vehicle with lights flashing. They all require probable cause, and the emergency vehicle situation spells out the probable cause that's needed. The school bus does not, and this bill does not spell it out. It just requires probable cause.
And Ms. Berezovsky, did I read correctly that an emergency vehicle also includes a tow truck for the move-over law purpose?
Mr. Chair, that's true. The other parked vehicles are in a different subdivision, and I don't think the four-hour provision applies to those. That's including the bill that's on the agenda next.
Right, and we haven't gotten to that
right
yet. And who can report? Who can report the failure to move over for the move over law purpose to establish probable cause?
Mr. Chair, as far as for the move over, right, it's a member of the crew of the vehicle has to report what happened, and which includes a description of the vehicle and the vehicle's plate number. So, and it has to be made within the 4 hours, of course. To allow the arrest within 4 hours. Then the school bus provision just requires probable cause. And I think the proponents at that time felt that it should not be necessarily spelled out, but left to the best judgment of the officer.
And
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, the council, in a school bus scenario, probably the most likely situation is it was a black four-door Buick car, license plate number, such and such, such and such, and I witnessed it. I imagine that would be similar to this bill, and to the chairman's question, who would report this? Likely the flagger, or could other people on the construction crew or company call this in as well? I don't know if you have that answer, Senator Kent.
Well, Mr. Chair, I and Senator Westrom, I think that there is no limitation in Senator Kent's language. So it would be up to the officer, if the stop were challenged, then to back up the assertion of reasonable cause. And there is no limitation to who can phone it in. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair and
Senator Kent.
Senator Westrom, you know, I can imagine in both of these scenarios where there would be other stopped cars who would observe a violating vehicle not observing the law. So whether it's the flagger or the school bus driver or additional cars and passengers who have the opportunity to capture some data and report it.
Sure. And Senator Westrom. Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, I mean, I think this specific scenario has some rationale as a committee, and I just raised the point, and maybe nobody else cares about it, but I do worry that we, you know, don't keep walking down a slippery slope. I think there's some merit to having police officers actually witness violations. Or what stops us from having cities just stand workers out on the street corners and take down license plates and say, well, that person didn't come to a complete stop at the stoplight, so send them a ticket, and this person didn't yield. Or, you know, you follow where I'm going, and I agree, understand that's maybe an exaggeration, but I also worry about that slippery slope of not having a witness an offense by people that have been trained and police officers, and I don't want to get into the point where it gets to be a grudge match between exes or friends or whatever the deal might be, and so I don't think that's where we are, but I raise that concern because I just want the committee to contemplate that as we look at these specific bills.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think maybe this question would be best directed to Senate Counsel. With the inclusion of the A1 amendment, which calls for petty misdemeanor for violation, do we in any way limit more serious charges that may be appropriate, for instance, in the scenario that was outlined in the pictures?
Question. Counsel.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, in 169, I think it's .88, I'm just looking here. It's not 88, sorry. I think it's 89, that when a petty misdemeanor can be enhanced to a misdemeanor, and that's general for the chapter. If the offense is committed in such a way as to endanger or be likely to endanger a person or property, it's enhanced automatically, or not automatically, but it can be enhanced to a misdemeanor.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Right. Thank you. All right. Anything further, committee? Senator Kent, anything further? Mr. Werke.
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tim Werke. I represent the Highway and Transportation Division of the Associated General Contractors. I'm here to support Senator Kent and what she's trying to do with this provision. She carried comprehensive works on safety legislation last year that passed the legislature and made a number of changes for the first time in almost 20 years in works on safety. This provision, however, did not survive the process. We think it's an important provision. It was linked to an increase in the fine, as you'll see in the A1 amendment, but the fine, I believe, last year was raised to $300 for violation of a flagger. But without this linked provision to the ability to have the infraction be reported and then have a licensed peace officer execute the enforcement. There really is no disincentive. If you have to just have a licensed peace officer at every remote work zone to witness the offense, it's a difficult lift. And as has been testified by the gentleman from MnDOT and others, that the flagger is probably the most exposed position in the work zone. And our members would echo the MnDOT testimony in terms of their concern about exposure. So we strongly support the provision. We would encourage the committee to look favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orkey. Questions, members? All right. Senator Kent, anything further?
That'll do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Would you like to move your bill? All right.
Yes, move the bill and...
Mr. Judiciary, yeah.
Yes.
So Senator Kent moves Senate File 1393 be recommended and referred, as amended, be referred and sent to the Committee on Judiciary. Any further members? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Kent. All right. Senator Carlson previewed your bill a moment ago. Senate File 1180. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. This bill is actually right on to Senator Kent's bill. I thank her for taking all the hard questions on it. What it does is it's very simple. It's Senate File 1180, and what it does is simply adds a bit more safety to the to the protections for utility workers. It expands the move-over law to include parked utility company vehicles with warning lights that are activated so that the driver who is passing this type of vehicle is required to move a lane away if possible to do so. In addition to its application to law enforcement vehicles, the law currently already applies to freeway service patrol vehicles, road maintenance vehicles, and construction vehicles. With me, I have Mr. Joel Johnson from the Rural Electric Association.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joel Johnson. I represent the here on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, which is made up of the 44 distribution electric cooperatives in the state and the six G&Ts that provide them power. Fortunately, I do not have a list of accidents this would have prevented, but every co-op that you will visit can tell you about close calls that they've had while working on the side of the road, and particularly in cases where lines are down, this can be a very, very dangerous situation. All we're asking and really want to try to do is just make the public more aware of the need to slow down and to move over if possible when they see trucks working on the side of the road. I'll be happy to answer any questions. Again, this is just a safety measure to make sure that our linemen can come home safe after a day's work. Their job is dangerous enough as it is without having to worry about traffic as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions, members? All right. Senator Sendrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really not a question. Senator Carlson, I support this bill. I don't have all the facts, but there's a part of me that wonders whether or not we ought to maybe apply this law to any parked car. And Friday night down by near Zumbrota, there was a situation, again, not all facts, but where a vehicle absolutely drove into a parked car along the highway. And this may have not prevented it. I'm not going to say that. But this move-over law probably isn't one that should be isolated for, you know, certain workers or groups or et cetera. Maybe it should apply to every car. Just a thought.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sendrum, I tend to agree with you. There are, of course, the disabled cars that don't have flashing lights that I'm not sure earn the same kind of move over law, but certainly those that have flashing lights. And I was reminded on my way in this morning that the highway workers were putting up barriers on 35E, and they had to have a truck following them with the bumper that's about 8 feet deep just to make sure that those people that are not paying attention don't do any damage to people or vehicles when they hit that special bumper. So, yes, I think we should be thinking about something like that.
And I'll just mention for the record, we did have a trooper during last week's slippery conditions. Was driven into, was taken over to Ramsey. I did speak with the commander of the State Patrol, sent our regards on behalf of the committee on to him. He's actually fine, but in the course of that discussion, we discussed that phenomenon of drivers kind of following their eyes and drifting into these vehicles on the side of the road, just because their wheel tends to, it's a phenomenon with some drivers. Their wheel follows where their eyes go, and that's how these accidents occur. So it's a larger discussion for a later point in time, but maybe we can address part of the problem with these vehicles that are frequently stopped on the side of the road with their flashers going. So, all right, so Senator Carlson, do you have, Senator Tomasoni, you look poised.
Well, just to Senator Senjum's point, I can remember when my son had a flat tire on 35, and it happened to be on the left-hand side of the car. And his comment to me was, these people don't move over, and it's really scary trying to change that tire. And so, what you're saying is well taken. So.
All right. Well, Senator Tomasoni, in favor of more laws regulating people's behavior. It's a first.
Safety first.
All right. Excellent. All right. Senator Carlson, a motion.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I move Senate File 1180 be recommended to pass and move on to the floor.
Floor. Great. Any questions, members? Would anyone else like to testify on Senate File 1180? Nope. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. That wraps us up, members. Not too bad. 4 o'clock.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Yep. I had a couple issues I was hoping to bring up to you in the committee. First, relating specifically to the governor's budget, do you have a sense when we might start that process with the deadline rolling up?
Yeah.
Here?
Are we looking at next week? Or?
Yeah.
Late next week.
Next week?
Yeah.
So
next week.
Next week. Okay. We'll start on the governor's budget.
Right.
And then I was just following up in regard to a message we received, too, about meeting on Fridays, potentially moving forward. And I think we had a conversation in our caucus, and the consensus was that we might prefer to do an evening or late afternoon, if that would fit into your schedule or committee schedule, rather than a Friday. I don't know if you got any pushback from from your members at all in regards to that Friday meeting date, but...
We'll have our staff talk and see. I mean, part of it is around room availability.
Okay, yes, certainly.
That's part of why, and part of it is around how diligent this committee is.
Yep.
And the number of bills, and we want to get some of your member bills as well. We have those on the list. So.
Yep, we appreciate that.
All right, great.
And then and lastly, I wanted to ask you about or bring up a situation that our office ran into that was a little bit disturbing in regards to some advocacy or constituent contacts we've gotten in regards to the Move Minnesota effort. My office received well over 100 of these cards like this, and I don't know if anybody else is getting those cards at all or not. But I followed up on these cards and wrote a letter to every person that sent me one, and was disturbed when I heard back from a constituent that said he had never filled out this card. And this constituent happens to be the warden of the prison, quite frankly, in St. Cloud, which is even more surprising. And so he was very concerned that somebody was representing his name for whether he supported the effort or not. He was more concerned about somebody using his name, filling in his address, which happens to be his office, and then certainly his phone number and state email address when he had no knowledge of that happening. And then as my staff reviewed the cards that we received, we have about 30% of the cards our office received were actually done in the same handwriting. And so, I know I have a concern that a lot of this effort is maybe be fraudulent on the effort of some of the folks supporting this movement, and was curious if there's any chance you would have an interest in trying to explore that or dig into that a little bit farther.
Sure.
At all.
Sure, Senator Peterson. Yeah, we can talk about that.
Okay.
I have no knowledge of what you've just described, and I think I know who that organization is. So.
Yep.
All right. Sure. We'll have a conversation about that.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Anything further, members? With that, we are adjourned.